Here we are on the Heritage Radio Network. This is the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Katie Kiefer.
And we actually have a guest host with us in-house, Katie. We have Mark Marabella from the Q Report is sitting in with us. You know Mark.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. Mark Marabella. Good.
Nice, <We're>, Mark.
Where are you, Katie?
I am in beautiful southern Rhode Island. If you listen hard, you'll be able to hear the birds chirping all around me. I'm up in the woods.
And the scallops scalloping?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And I'm sitting on the screened-in back porch of my sister's beautiful home with her lovely dog next to me, panting away. I just spent a couple hours weeding the gardens at my mother's ramshackle old house, which we still own but don't live in. So it's like every time we come up here, we're greeted by a watery disaster and oceans of landscaping work. But it's all good. It's really nice to be up here, especially this time of year. So,
how's your sister?
She's doing okay for somebody who could have easily gone into sort of an end phase of her life. I mean, aside from just the general danger of taking a bad fall off a horse, she could have lost the use of her legs, etc. So she was very lucky.
Wow.
Her sacrum actually cracked from top to bottom.
What's a sacrum? It's a part of the skull?
It's a part of your spine.
Yeah, the back.
It's that bony plate at the bottom base of your spine, which always hurts if you're prone
terrible.
To low backache. And it's where all of your major nerve bundles emerge from the spinal cord, and then they come through the sacrum and down your legs. So any injury to those nerves can be potentially life-changing.
And yeah, it's,
she was,
you know,
enormously lucky.
Back in the days that
damage.
I'm sure you know, Katie, but back in the days that horse travel was common, it was one of the falling off a horse is one of the most common causes of death, actually, because from dying from injuries or infection. So it's a very serious thing, even today, of course.
Yeah, and even for, my sister's been riding horseback her entire life, and she's a really good horsewoman, but you cannot, you know, account for your animal at all times. It's
right.
It's a big beast. It moves fast, and she just, you know, the horse got spooked by a cat, and he spun one way, and she went flying.
And horses are, you know, the size of, you're falling down from the side, you know, from 6 or 7 feet high. I mean,
yeah,
it's,
that's right.
I think people
yeah.
really realize how tall it is where you're landing from.
Yeah,
I mean, really.
Not until you get up on one,
exactly,
you realize,
right?
Oh,
no,
golly,
they're very tall.
I sure don't want to fall off of this thing.
Well,
yeah,
horses are.
My horseback riding days are over. She claims hers are, but I say different.
Well, side saddle may be in her future.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
the
right, exactly. yeah, or landing gear, one or the other. So we have a great show lined up today, you guys, right?
Well, we do, and we're about to have Jean Mayer from Baldor, followed
That's
by
right.
George Fazen from DeBragen Spittler,
okay.
and Steve Schmoller from Cisco. So distribution
actually,
is...
Steve is not from Cisco. He is a restaurant owner and chef who has put together a distribution system with the assistance of Cisco.
Oh.
So, He's really, I think, one of the more interesting little pieces of the puzzle, because distribution is a part of our food chain that I think most people rarely give any thought to, and yet it accounts for so much of what is available to us and what gets into grocery stores and what gets into restaurants. So Steve has managed to harness one of these big broadline distributors that are normally sort of, well, shall we say, not our best friends necessarily, and make it work to the advantage of his local agricultural community as well as the community at large. So it's a neat story. But I'm looking forward to hearing Jean Baldor's story from, Jean Mayer's story from Baldor, because he's been working hard to establish a network of local producers that he can then move their goods into the New York City area and beyond. So.
And then, you know, we are coming off this distribution theme is a good one for us because Heritage Foods, the other company we work with is that I work with is a distributor.
Yeah.
And talking of such, you do know that you did see those articles, Katie, right? They get the New York Times and the Internet
sure
out
did.
On Rhode Island.
Sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
We were listed in the 25 and under. It was a great review of Roberta's.
It's fantastic
Rave.
Review for Roberta's. Yeah.
Rave.
I mean, it was
well-deserved,
gushing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it mentioned us, and they also came out in an article called Bushwick Gardens and Tasting Table.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there was a blog by Oliver Schwaner Albright, who wrote the 25 and Under column, just about us. So
fantastic.
We are blowing up.
Yeah, on the map. On the map. You gotta love it.
That's the sound of exploding creativity, not exploding demolish. Right?
Exactly. That's explosive demolition. Creativity. Yeah. So we are basically done with the intro, and I guess we'll go right into talking with Gene.
Gene Mayer.
Gene, are you with us? Okay, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with Gene. Great job, Katie, getting Gene on, by the way.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Hey, we are here at the Heritage Radio Network with, I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Mark Marabella.
And we are with a very important figure in the food world. We have Gene Mayer from Baldor on as a guest. Gene, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Gene. I'm so glad you could join us today. It's really great to have somebody who's part of the distribution community come on to really tell consumers and the rest of the population what kind of a role distribution plays in how we get what we eat and where it comes from and where it goes. So
and how far it goes.
Yeah, and how far it goes. So, Gene, maybe you would start off by talking about how you got Baldor's involved in sort of the local agriculture movement and sustainable agriculture and was working with, I think you had a group of farmers up in the Catskills, and I know you work with Everard Muller out on Long Island, so maybe we could start with hearing a little bit of that history there.
Are you on?
Yes, Gene? I am, and I can hear you perfectly, Patrick, and Katie's very distant in the phone.
Oh, really?
She asked me how Baldor's involved in local produce.
A little bit of history. Yeah.
A little history, yeah.
Okay, well, Baldor was founded in 1991, and we grew into a very large fresh fruit and vegetable distribution company in the New York City area. We distribute fruits and vegetables to various food service establishments, all the way from schools, restaurants, and corporate feeding and alike. One of the things that was the founding principle for the owner, Kevin Murphy, was day freshness and trying to stay as fresh as possible. And with our location here on the East Coast, that's always been a challenge, as most of the fruits and vegetables are grown elsewhere. But when you talk about the local produce and what's available to us locally, you find that we try to purchase anything we can from the local market.
And how do you buy from the local market? Have you organized farmers into groups yourselves, or did those groups already exist? How did you really unpack those first connections with local agriculture?
You know, the Union Square Market proved over the last 25 years or so to be kind of a laboratory for where the growers would come. And we've tried everything from individual relationships with culinarians who've gone into farming and growing, two cooperatives that are funded by different state agencies.
Fantastic. And one more on the historical aspect. I mean, basically, the divisions of Baldor, you have an international division, a fresh cut division, an organic division, and a cold storage division. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. We're trying to utilize our refrigeration and our integrity with the cold chain and distribution network to avail other companies that grow and try to distribute and market their products. Because basically, we're box in, box out. We move over 250,000 packages of over 1,700 different light items every week. And although most of what we distribute, like our top 50 items, constitute over a third of our business, it's those unique and special items and new items to the market that make us different.
Well, who's your primary customer that you're delivering all the product to?
Well, half of our customers are independent restaurants here in the tri-state area. We are contracted, and that's another portion of our business. And we actually sell to people who do exactly what we do, who maybe a company has 5-10 trucks, and they sell fresh fruits and vegetables. If they're running short and they can't find something in the market to keep us fresh, we will sell them as well.
It's really amazing, especially for a restaurant distribution. You know, you really have to have a fast turnaround and a fast delivery for the restaurant, especially in New York.
That's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
And
that's
how does it operate?
Large.
It operates, you do same-day deliveries in New York City if people order by 11, but then for the most part, in Boston or New York, you can order the day before and get it delivered that next day.
That's correct.
What is your area of deliveries?
Yes, well, we have 150 trucks, and some of our contracts have brought us down to Philadelphia, and it's only a two-hour ride. And then we tried to build the routes around them to make them grow. But the biggest challenge is the freshness factor. You don't have time to market a baby lettuce. It
right.
needs to be sold before it gets to you.
Exactly.
You know?
And do you do sales, or do people call you? I mean, how much pushing goes on, and how much are you pulled? I mean, is it just a bunch of messages you guys download, or are you actually pushing certain products? And then also I want to ask how farmers communicate to you what they have, and how do you communicate that to the restaurants?
Well, we have a sales force that will be out in the field, and we also use all the traditional marketing that you'll find in any business, whether it be faxes or, blast emails and the like. Yes, our contracts will come to us, and they'll tell us what their programs are on a monthly or quarterly basis. But as a company, we see where our industry is going, so we'll get out there and promote the seasonality and the items as they come in. Mother Nature and what's grown and comes out of the ground is on somewhat of a calendar. So you find a lot of the chefs are marketing towards what's going to become a harvest.
Yes, of course. Gene, are you able to, do you write a contract with a producer, for example, in advance to say, you know, I want to be able to guarantee my customers X number of boxes of baby lettuce, and can you be sure to grow that for me? Or do you just have to wait for them to decide what their... You guys work in tandem, I guess, is what I'm asking or getting at.
Again, I'm having a little problem here,
yeah,
Katie.
She's going to relate. Katie was asking if it's a little bit, are they ordering, let's say, baby bib, or is it something you're saying we have baby bib available to the restaurants?
They're ordering their items, and we are procuring to fill a historical demand. So there's two aspects of our procurement department. One is replenishment based upon traditional purchasing patterns from our clients. The other is strategic buying and marketing, and those programs are different depending upon which category we're working with. But definitely our industry tells us what our clientele wants, and we have that in stock for them.
Are you finding that, I wanted to ask you, especially for the restaurant business, and something Patrick has been pushing with Heritage Foods, do you find that the chefs and the restaurants are now ordering more locally and also, more importantly, more seasonally?
As uniformly.
Yeah,
you know,
I'll
take that small tomato because I understand that it's not grown on a factory farm.
Right. And you know, in New York, at least, we can certainly say the restaurants that we go to, a lot of them are giving us seasonal menus, you know, spring or summer. Are you finding that, has that changed your business at all or not as much?
The last 5 years has been phenomenal with the shift towards what is best available and at the same time local sustainable. It's not just I need to have strawberries in January. You know, they're building their menus around seasonality for sure.
Well, we will continue this very interesting conversation. It's, as someone who does Heritage Foods, who started that from nothing, definitely Baldor was an inspiration. So we're excited to come back with Gene Mayer on the Heritage Radio Network.
Great. Stay with us.
are back on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
I'm Mark Marabella, sitting in.
And we are have Gene Mayer from Baldor. And, you know, for anyone who wants to, who missed the first part of the interview, they can go to the heritageradionetwork.com and do a search for Gene Mayer or for Baldor or for any of the issues he brought up. And we'll find nice package segments, you know, people can listen to. So, Katie, where did we leave off right at the end of the last segment?
Well, we were talking about how the industry has changed in terms of seasonality, what chefs are ordering, and sort of how outfits like Baldor's can actually contract with growers to say, I think we're going to move X number of boxes of this, make sure you grow that, and vice versa. That there's a lot more sort of interchange between the distribution networks and the actual producers of agricultural items.
Which is great. More communication. It's fantastic. I was surprised to hear, Katie, this is Mark, I was surprised to hear him say that in the last 5 years that it's really, you know, increased in that way. That's really good news.
I think it's fantastic, and I think it's all part of this whole sort of local and sustainable movement that has so much changed so many aspects of the way we eat, and especially of the distribution system that carries our food around. Is Gene still there?
Gene, you with us?
Yes, I'm still here. I just have a hard time hearing Katie.
You guys, would you ask him then a little bit about sort of how they plan to build out on sort of what's happening now? Like, will they be able to, for example, guarantee certain contracts to farmers so that farmers can invest in more infrastructure? Maybe, for instance, grow things in January that are not necessarily seasonal, but they could build greenhouses for them, stuff like that, so that we're not shipping strawberries from Chile every year. Or
did you hear that, Gene? Did you hear that?
If you could just paraphrase that for me.
What's the next step? Where is this growing? How does it grow? Do you contract with farmers and you know, so that they know for sure that they can grow something unusual or unique and have an outlet through it?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We work with growers, and we tell them what our historic purchases have been and allow them that information to plan their harvest. At the same time, growers who are forward-thinking will come to us and plan the year in advance. Those relationships turn out to be the best. It's hard for us to react to support a grower who comes to me and says, I have this coming next week. What should I do? Mm-hmm. And it's part of that planning process that makes us the best partner for them. Definitely having the information prior to harvest helps us to be a better distributor for them.
Ask Gene how he thinks food habits for consumers have changed. I know he mostly works with food service, but obviously food service has to reflect the consumer trends. And that's what really interests me is how different people are thinking about what they buy in grocery stores and what they expect to see and want to see.
Are people's food desires changing? I mean, has your historic demand changed of late?
It has. It's going towards the more, more traditional taste characters and profiles of what's grown. Not looking for something out of the ordinary necessarily, but if it's meant to be a beautiful baby red oak and the leaves are going to be a little supple, but it's going to have the right taste profile and the right color for the plate, that's more important than these huge, abundant heads. And taking the best of what's available and learning how to use it, that's what the culinarians are doing now. They do know how to take what's available and make it spectacular.
What is the greatest challenge to what you do? As someone who's in Cleveland or Nebraska and they say, you know, we want to help farmers get their products to market, what advice would you give them? What lessons do you learn, and what's still a challenge for you?
Well, it's about supply and demand, as it's always been. And if the clientele, if the customers are willing to participate and support the local movement, even at their local marketplace or in their local restaurant, then the demand will get greater and the supply chain will react. I mean, last year was the first time a major Western grower brought his entire operation to Orange County, New York, just to satisfy the local demand in this area. had a lot to do with transportation and fuel, but now that those costs are down, we still need to remember the philosophy behind it in supporting the local communities, and that comes with the customer.
It's interesting. One last question I wanted to ask about the difference. You know, often from a consumer standpoint, as Katie was pointing out, people always say, "Well, what's the difference between me going out to dinner versus purchasing in a supermarket?" And I don't know if you supply local grocers or ateliers in such a way, but do you see any difference on the retail side in that way? Because obviously, I would think you can tell me different, but I would think that it would be more difficult to supply the restaurant because it's more immediate, it's more now versus a grocery store.
Well, grocery stores have something called distribution warehouses, and they're called distribution centers or DCs. And the difficulty with groups of grocery stores is they do a national buying program on an annualized basis.
Right.
So they're locked in and buying, and it's very difficult for me to sell that distribution center. It's a little easier into the restaurants. However, you will find there are a few supermarket chains in our area that are asking us to get the local produce to them during the season.
So from the sense of the market share, does that represent a larger purchasing power from the grocery stores and their distribution centers? Is that meaning the dent that we're making in a good way with local and seasonal in the restaurants, is it 25% of the market versus 75% in the grocery stores? Do you have an idea what those numbers might be?
Yes, and you're right about there. They say about 80% of everything that's grown is already pre-purchased by the retail sector.
Right,
and food service is kind of a stepchild, and we're actually in the food service arena. We're starting things now that retail is turning and saying, hey, we want to get involved too.
Right.
That is very, very interesting. And one last question. We have about 30 seconds left. How have you navigated the international produce exchange wing of your business after having worked with so many local farmers? Is that a challenge to develop trusting relationships with people in other countries?
Yeah, it really is. The hardest part is certifying the farmers. We have to get down, whether it be to Panama or Guatemala or Costa Rica, and learn the culture there and learn to build the relationship, because it is a long-distance relationship. And it involves sometimes giving seed money, and there's a big trust there when you're sending money down and to get the seed going. But those relationships take time, but we're willing to do what it takes.
Well, this has been absolutely awesome to have you on. You know, we at Heritage Radio Network are a big believer in having, you know, great guests come on often, not just once. So, you know, we want to be a real resource for people, especially in our archive. So we do hope, Gene, you'll come back again and give us some more time and wisdom.
Well, I really appreciate having me on, and I really support what you guys are up to. It's where we need to be, and Bowler just wants to support us, so thank you.
Katie's,
thank you very much, Gene.
Katie just said thank you.
You got it.
From another friend of the show.
Okay.
Awesome. We will take a break and come back with Mark and Katie, and we have an in-house guest, George Faison, and his wife, Stephanie.
Oh, you lucky thing. We'll be right back.
Hi, George. We're back.
We're here.
Gene, are you with us? I mean, Gene, Katie, are you with us?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Great.
Are George and Stephanie there?
Yes, they're right here. I'm looking at
Hello.
Them.
Hello.
Hey, Katie.
Hi, George. Hi, Stephanie.
We miss you.
I know. I miss you guys. And you're going to be enjoying a pizza pretty soon that I'm really missing right about
we
now.
Are.
We
Hold
already
on.
Are.
Let them swallow so they can answer.
Gulp.
So we are really honored to have George and Stephanie here. Now, George Faison, tell us, I mean, I don't even know how to define you. I mean, you have had such a powerful arc in your career in terms of how you've affected the New York City and national food scene, for that matter. How would you, what do you do? Who are you? Tell us a little bit.
I'm somebody who likes really good food, so the best way to guarantee that is to get involved in helping produce it and
exactly.
bringing it to market.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Now, you started early on. I heard a great old story about you, like at the base of the Lincoln Tunnel, making exchanges with small farms. And it was on those shoulders that, you know, a lot was built. I mean, you were a seminal figure in bringing cured meats and foie gras and those kind of French items and introducing that to the U.S. market, were you not?
Well, it was even more, I would say more broadly, it was bringing the forgotten, if you will, poultries and meats of the world. We think of it as game meats, but squabs and a lot of ducks and rabbits are actually typically poultry in European countries, and people had forgot about it. The center of the plate in New York 25, 30 years ago was dominated by pretty much, for the most part, insipid beef, lamb, chicken.
And what maybe, were the know. Restaurants even back then? Were there as many restaurants in the 70s and 80s as they are now?
No, there was not nearly as many restaurants.
Nothing like it.
Nothing like it, and they were very much either high-end or very low-end. There was not anything in the middle in the context of, say, your bistros or trattorias that you see today.
Mm. Wouldn't you say that French dominated, though?
Well, on the high-end, French definitely dominated, and it was about refined cooking and very fancy sauces, which, as we all know, and this is a joke and a little dig at my French friends, great sauces were invented to cover old meat.
Exactly.
So.
Right. Exactly. But oh so good. Oh, so good.
Nothing like a béarnaise on a rancid piece of beef, you know?
But I would argue, too, with the explosion of restaurants, there's also explosion of mediocre restaurants. You know, I find that there are great charcuteries, there are great brasseries that you can find, but it's rarer and more difficult. There's a lot of mediocre ones in between all that. Would you agree with that? Or?
Well, there's always going to be a cutting edge. I think what's most important now is perhaps somebody's skills are not as sharp as someone else's, but their desire to utilize good ingredients has grown dramatically. I mean, that becomes, I'm going to play with a much better quality paint than I ever would have played with before. They may not know what the hell to put on the canvas, but at the same time, they're starting with a good raw material.
You know, my wife loves to cook, as Patrick knows, and Patrick supplies a lot of the meat for our dinners that we have a big table, and her rallying cry, which seems so obvious, but for some reason was lost, is that if you start with good ingredients, you know, it's like you don't have to sort of smother in sauce, so to speak.
Well, you don't want to do
right. He's
too
like,
much
like
to
so when
something.
She yeah, when she gets Patrick's meat, it's like that's the course. Taste it, right?
Look, even
cook it in such a way that's the flavor. We're eating red wattle tonight. We're eating Berkshire. That's what we're eating.
Even
right?
The finest dining in the world has realized. I mean, this goes back to your Ducasse's, your Arpège, with these great guys and these great top French restaurants. It actually became less is more. Get an extraordinary quality squab and let the flavor of the squab sing through.
Mm-hmm. It seems so obvious and strangely that we've gone beyond, you know, we're coming back to that, but it seems strange.
We've cycled back. And I think that this is where the common denominator in whether it's an inexpensive bistro or a brasserie or the finest dining is, start with that raw material. It's what you do to it. It's the trappings you enjoy it in that are going to dictate the price. What am I paying for my real estate, for my decor, cutlery?
Yeah.
That's going to dictate that extra $20, $30 per plate as opposed to the same bird served on a paper plate with a mason jar beer is still the same excellent quality product to begin with.
Which in New York people will go to.
Yeah, no, people flock to quality.
Yeah, they will.
New York City's good at weeding out mediocrity.
is the essence, isn't it? It's that how do we get rid of mediocre quality product in the world? Is that we encourage people to spend a little more for something much better.
An alternative.
And perhaps eat less of it. or not necessarily have to have it in a fancy trapping, but just enjoy it for what it truly is, not what it's being purported to
and
be.
And you're a big alternative offerer. You make alternatives happen. Now, one of your big things is dry aging beef. I mean, that's probably one of the things that's most unique about what you do. There's a certain art form to it. Tell us a little bit about that program.
Well, when I left D'Artagnan, I sold to my partner 5 years ago. A big part of that was that a big focus of what we were selling were basic meats, your beef, your veal, your lamb, your pork, and that we weren't really focused in doing the things that I knew you could do, such as working with smaller producers with special breeds. And in the context of beef, one of the great things that you can do with great beef is you can change it, you can evolve it. There's an aspect mm-hmm. that the human element can have, and not just in the raising of it, but in the finishing of it, which is what dry aging is. To take a great cut of beef and to let it age for 30 or 45 or 50 days, allowing it to truly ferment. It's not unlike aging cheese or aging wine or aging tobacco. Mm-hmm. It takes something great and takes it to a new level. And that's what I'd never had an opportunity to do before. And basically, dry-aged beef, before I started, bought into DeBraga and started changing their program, was taking commodity beef, putting it on a shelf for the period of time. The cryovac bag was wet aging.
To talk about the whole wet aging movement and how when people found out about cryovac, dry aging went away. And you guys really, to a large measure, reintroduced that to the New York City restaurant market.
Well, that's a good point, Katie. Thanks for bringing that up, because I was heading down what you can do with great in dry aging, working with really special breeds that are naturally raised. The whole problem with the beef industry is that they're raising animals using growth hormones to accelerate their weight gain, putting them in high-density feedlots, and then giving them subtherapeutic antibiotics when they inevitably get sick. And what that all leads to is less expensive but mediocre beef.
Yeah. Right.
And when you dry-age mediocre beef, you get mediocre dry-aged beef. Now, when you take something out of that confine, so say you raise it without hormones, which takes a little bit longer, but the animal is much healthier. It doesn't need the subtherapeutic antibiotics. When you feed it over a slower period of time, instead of rushing it and giving it a high grain diet, you give it a much more varied diet, increase the caloric content, you get an enhanced marbling. You get a healthier animal, better marbling, better flavor,
yeah.
And then you dry age that. Now you're talking nirvana, at least as far as beef's concerned.
Well, we are very excited. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back talk with George and Stephanie. We're going to talk a little bit about fish and also a little bit about hunting. So we'll be right back on the Heritage Radio Network.
No use to you.
It's May 31st.
That was a very hippie trip, man.
Very hippie trip. Are you talking about what you just inhaled?
Right back.
No, I'm talking, Katie, you know. I'm talking about the music, and I'm like, I feel like I'm in my VW bus.
VW bus with the ankle straps.
Yeah,
that's what my friend used to call
those. It's a big montage chopper shot as I'm driving away west onto my, with my day trippers.
George, I want to ask you a couple questions about hunting before we get back to the usual stuff. I just heard this joke about a guy who went to jail for eating a bald eagle. And the judge was like, how could you eat our national symbol? And he's like, I have an explanation. The eagle was sick. It was swooping down. It was about to kill my dog. So I picked up a rock. I threw it at it. It hit it. It was a lucky shot, unlucky shot. I don't know. It died. So to honor it, I ate it. My next door neighbor reported me. And now I'm in jail. So the judge is like, I'll let you go. But I do need to know, what did it taste like? And he answers, halfway between a panda bear and a Komodo dragon. People were like, well, wait a minute.
But, and if Ben Franklin had his way, we'd be eating bald eagles on Thanksgiving.
I know.
That's right. And turkey would be the symbol.
That's right, exactly.
What do you hunt? Where do you hunt? And tell us a little bit. Not many hunters left, it seems. Certainly not in the urban areas.
Well, quite frankly, there could be a lot more hunters in the urban areas, and there's more than you realize. Some of the greatest striped bass fishing now is right in New York Harbor under the Verrazanos.
Yeah, that's right.
That's been because the Hudson's been cleaned up.
Okay.
Within 30 minutes of New York, you can go out and collect wild ramps and fiddlehead ferns on the side of streams. You can be trout fishing and such. Perhaps you're not doing bird hunting per se or deer hunting, but
duck in some places.
Yeah, duck in some places. Quite frankly, a lot of communities are allowing bow hunters to pursue within their parks to thin out deer herds that unfortunately are beyond the ability of the environment to sustain. So there's some great opportunities, and at the same time, it's rather ironic. Here we are. What's the real world, the world that we created or the one that nature created? It's funny to bounce between both within 30 minutes of Manhattan.
What are some of the things you've hunted like throughout the years? I mean, do you go to Montana sometimes, or do you mainly stay in this area?
I love to hunt a lot of stuff. I mean, for me, it's a way to get out into the world. The misconception is that hunting means killing. That inevitably happens occasionally, but the main thing is, when I'm pursuing woodcock with my bird dog, we are in marshland in late fall in some real thick, wild areas. And he's doing his thing and I'm doing mine. And we get to separate ourselves from the real world. When I'm bow hunting elk out in Montana or New Mexico or Wyoming, it's trying to keep up with an animal that's meant for that environment. And to even pretend that I might have a chance to do that is extraordinary.
Well, hunting is very seasonal as well. I mean, I don't know that people really understand that, but turkey hunting in April and May. And
right. Well, Son and I were just up in the Catskills outside of the east, just off the east branch of the Delaware, pursuing turkeys and fly fishing for trout. And
We're going to be hunting morel and other mushrooms too.
Well, that's the summertime hunting.
Delicious.
Is chanterelle season.
Totally.
Black trumpets come in late July and early August.
Fantastic.
And can you sell what you hunt through DeBraga? I mean, what are the rules on that?
The rules on hunting are that, in fact, back in the 30s, during the last Depression, people were starving. So they were, and then there was, even prior to that, there was a lot of market hunting where a lot of your wild populations around the New York metro area were hunted out. Ducks and such at the turn of the century, deer, wild turkeys were brought into the restaurants and hotels. And that led to the industry around Pekin duck farming on Long Island, was to supplant what had been shot out. Huh. So along came Teddy Roosevelt, and he realized that this was not good for the animals. It certainly wasn't good for the hunters because they had nothing left to hunt. So they started creating laws around what you could take, when you could take it. And then in the 30s, they even pushed that further because people were hunting things to the brink of extinction because they were starving. So where was the balance in that? Mm-hmm. Today, they do not allow the commercial resale of wildlife that a hunter shoots. I could take it to a restaurant and go, chef, prepare this for me, but there can be no commercial exchange.
So then when I eat venison in a restaurant, that's from a farm?
That is from a farm.
Now, unless you taste lead in it.
Well, that could be what the water has that the animal's drinking, but no. The farms, there's been a lot of farm raising of deer in New Zealand. There's some in the United States as well on a small basis, so there's bison raising. Quite frankly, it's bison ranchers who saved the bison from extinction.
Patrick knows something about that.
Have you ever been to those Texas big properties where you can choose the animal and you pay for like a lion or something like that? I mean,
I find that absolutely reprehensible.
That's
for
crazy.
Me, that's not hunting. It's just like going into a zoo and helping them call their animals. I mean, that
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, it's like
you're
really not in the environment at that point.
No, the key is that I'm not gonna. It's like the bow hunters and the rifle hunters saying one's better than another. For me, the beauty of the hunt is the free chase. I've hunted introduced animals, which are Aldad sheep were introduced in the Chinatus Mountains east of El Paso. And that area is very similar to the Sudan where they originally came from.
Very dry,
the herds are doing better in West Texas than they're doing in the Sudan, as you can imagine. And yet the hunt is one of the hardest and most difficult I've ever done. They are wild.
Terrible terrain there, too.
And rough, rugged, but stunningly wild. Mm. And that's, for me, it's what it's about. It's not about what I shoot. It's what I experience while I'm doing it.
Right.
And being inside a cage... Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that doesn't do it for me.
Doesn't do it for
you. It's like fishing and baseball. It's not about the game. It's about the company you bring.
And that's about the company
really,
you bring.
Because really, that's really most of the time you're spending.
It's about the competition. How hard is it? What do I learn by pursuing it? What am I getting out of
Katie,
it?
Katie, are you still there?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I'm listening to this with great interest. I mean, there was a very interesting article in the New Yorker a few weeks ago or months ago about all of the different types of livestock that were once considered wild that are now being raised in Texas. For some reason, Texas has become a hotbed for this. So there are huge deer farms there. There are the bison farms. And there are other livestock that, I think are going into the restaurants or into food service. And these guys, a lot of these guys, are hoping to build that out more and more. Do you find that, for instance, George, at DeBraga and Spittler, that you guys are being approached by producers with different kinds of livestock that they're trying to kind of make a play for? I mean, I know Bill Nyman, for example, is talking up goats in a big way. Do you find other producers talking up other animals that they're hoping to introduce into the consumer market?
Well, the interesting thing about that, Katie, is for me, that was 15 years ago, if you will, that it was very, it's still big. It's still happening. My interest in the context of D'Artagnan was very much around helping those kinds of people, people that were raising squabs or rabbits or black buck antelope or bison, and bringing those animals into the market, because it's all about different flavors and different textures, things that are grass-fed as opposed to grain-fed. My own personal interest drifted into what were majority of the people consuming the majority of the time, and where would I be able to have the greatest impact on improving the way these animals were raised, and improving the way they were finished, and improving the quality of what the majority of the people ate most of the time. That's why I drifted into more towards the beef and the pork in the lamb segment of the market rather than staying in the game segment.
And now, Stephanie, you are involved a little bit in the fish, or a lot in the fish segment, which, Jory, I don't think DeBraga and Spittler are big into fish.
No. I leave all the meat stuff to my husband.
Tell us what you do.
I've been involved with Seafood Choices Alliance since helping to start it in 2001. It's all about sustainability and seafood, but my organization really targets industry. So we're working with restaurants, we're working with food service, we're working with caterers, retailers. For people, well, nationally, there are lots of great consumer organizations to turn to find out about what fish we should be eating with great confidence and feeling good about, and ones that we should eat occasionally, and then ones that we ought to avoid. I would recommend anybody go to, locally here in New York, the Blue Ocean Institute.
Okay.
And then, of course, Monterey Bay Aquarium on the West Coast has a fabulous Seafood Watch program to help people figure out what they should be eating.
So Blue Ocean Institute?
Where is that?
It's on the East Coast. Long Island. Mm. Actually started, it was Carl Safina and Mercedes Lee broke off from the Audubon Society's ocean program and started this several years ago. And they have a very robust program in the New York area, bringing chefs and people in closer to sources. You know, we talk about locavore so much with agriculture, with livestock and with produce. It's very difficult to do that with seafood.
That's so bizarre to me because, of course, New York City specifically used to be the oyster capital for that very reason.
Because of
the rivers and because of the bogs.
The Delaware River was the caviar
capital.
You know,
and it's ironic too that you say that. I'm very surprised to hear that, although not completely. Because seafood, of course, spoils faster. So you would think you'd have to have it more local.
Well, here's the thing. If you're not near a Great Lake or a river or a coast, you're not going to be able to do it locally. It's tough to do. Now I'm going to get messed up, but like Kentucky or Idaho or Montana, where are you going to tap into if
Kansas.
It's not a stream?
Montana for
Kansas.
Trout.
Right. Montana for trout. Idaho for trout, yeah, the right. Salmon River.
Right. But
this is one sound you would never hear in Kansas.
Yeah, don't.
I don't even know what that is. Don't eat sushi there. but here's my, I'm on a personal mission. I haven't even told my colleagues at Seafood Choices Alliance this. But, you know, you talk about farmers markets. I want to bring fishermen to farmers markets. I want to do fisher farmers markets.
Yeah. Yeah, why
absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely.
Why not?
And
right,
change
of course.
The distribution network.
As it used to be, you know, it's called Fulton
close.
Market. Oh, by the way, Fulton
yeah,
Market,
exactly.
right? That's what we used to have that, right?
It used to be fabulous. And,
yeah.
and people talk about the auctions in Portland, Maine and Boston, Massachusetts. You know, we need this kind of feeling all across the country about seafood.
Absolutely. Well, you you know, anyone who, you know, wants to can look at our website, Heritage Radio Network, and they'll find words, tags like Blue Ocean Institute, Seafood Choices Alliance, and debraga.com, which is a very exciting new, you know, which can be linked to from our site, debraga.com, debraga.com, which is a chance for people to get the great foods you serve to restaurants, but delivered straight to their homes. Right, George?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, great. And we hope you guys will come back. It looks like you guys like Roberta's, so that means we'll be lucky enough to have you as guests again. And we are going to take a break and come back with Steve Schmoller. From Ohio.
Excellent. Speaking of.
Here we are back on the Heritage Radio Network.
Grooving, baby.
Grooving on the Heritage Radio
totally
Network.
Totally grooving, man.
Totally grooving.
Katie, are you grooving over there?
I'm so grooving on. I'm grooving on these breaks. The
just making sure.
Great.
Katie, man, how's the weather up there? Because here it's like a perfect day.
It was a perfect day yesterday. It's a little overcast today. It's a real Rhode Island day today.
Yeah.
Kind of what it's like down here in southern Rhode Island, right near the coast. Yeah. That's right.
And now, why don't you introduce our next guest? This is a pretty big catch for us, you know, to get this guy on. He's doing really big things. Katie, why don't you tell us?
Well, our next guest is Steve Schmoller from Cleveland, Ohio. He is a chef and restaurateur. He owns a restaurant called Crop in Cleveland. And about a year ago, I interviewed Steve because I did an article about distribution, which is kind of how I got interested in the whole food chain aspect of it. And Steve was just launching a project then called Local Crop. And Local Crop is a consortium of farmers, restaurants, and
They are all tied together by Sysco, one of the biggest broadline distributors in the United States. Everybody has seen those big Sysco trucks, S-Y-S-C-O. They're huge. They deliver all over the United States, and they work with all of the really big food service operations, hospitals, restaurants, institutions of every kind. And they also serve as groceries as well, grocery stores, I mean. So anyway, Steve, who had worked sort of on the corporate side of things in past lives, and Steve, you could explain all that, then managed to persuade Sysco, this was especially when the fuel crisis was acute, that it would be very much worth their while to pick up the produce from local farmers and deliver it to local restaurants,
wow.
creating a bit of a loop there.
Interesting.
Which the farmers would otherwise have been spending an enormous amount of fuel and time uh-huh. in trying to get their product to market, and the restaurant owners were spending an enormous amount of time sourcing from each individual farmer instead of being able to order through Sysco.
Right. That is amazing. How did you do that, Steve?
A lot of willpower. But Katie did a great job in setting that up, so it made it pretty easy for me.
Did you come up with this idea? Who did you call first? I mean, did you see the need first? Did you get a call first? I mean, where did this all happen? It's an amazing story.
You know, it really started in 1993 with a concept that evolved to be called ChefExpress.com that I ended up selling to Sysco in 2002. It was very pre-internet, but at the time I kind of was looking as an operator, as a chef, restaurateur, better access to artisan ingredients. And Chef Express was the first kind of solution. It was actually teed up with Federal Express and American Express, thus the name Chef Express. But the idea really came about after I had actually sold ChefX and was working with Sysco on looking at what the next generation of this kind of specialty distribution network could be. And it just was so obvious that utilizing an existing infrastructure that Sysco has nationally was just so visible to me to say, hey, there's a way to do this. And it wasn't really difficult to talk anyone into it. Everyone just really wants to do the right thing today.
That's amazing to me that, first of all, you had the idea, and secondly, you think they would actually buy it. I mean, because this seems like an obvious thing, but the obvious things always seem to take a lot of work and convincing. Was that the case?
You know, it was the way it was kind of laid out, it was an obvious thing that we're using everything that they're already doing, with the exception of what we've added on, which is this virtual marketplace.
So technically, not so much cost for them, technically.
Exactly. And, you know, this would not have been possible even, you know, 6-7 years ago. The technology platforms have really been responsible for enabling us to communicate with farmers on a real-time basis and with customers on a real-time basis.
So how does it work? I'm a farmer. I have like 50 cases of tomatoes. What happens?
Well, one of the key things that we really focus on, because it is such an important issue, is food safety. And it starts with vetting and qualifying suppliers. We're not selling stuff that's out of someone's backyard or something out of their garage, per se. It really starts with looking at people who have been doing it for a while, who are certified or approved from the local governmental agencies, i.e. FDA. They have to be insured. They have to protect themselves. So we look at the menu, if you will, as a chef. We have kind of an advisory board of local chefs who add a lot of value by saying, hey, these are the things we want on our menu. Yes, we need tomatoes, and yes, we need lettuce. We'll also like some specialty stuff. But it starts with us looking at what we need, and then the build it and they will come, as has happened already. The first dozen farmers and suppliers were a little difficult to get on board just because they didn't understand what we're doing. But as soon as the word of mouth gets around, we're going to have 120 suppliers online as of next week with probably about 350, 400 items.
Does Sysco make money off of this program yet?
You know, it's definitely not about the money right now. The critical mass it will evolve. But basically, what's really important about this for the farmers is we allow them to set the price that they need, fair market, for them to make money. And this is all very visible. It's kind of interesting because the farmer gives us a price. Sysco adds kind of a traditional margin to it that they would to normal produce or meat or whatever. It's then posted on the website for everyone to see. So there's pricing parity across all the restaurants. And what's important is that the farmers are setting a price, and that's what they're getting paid. They're not being forced to take stuff to an auction and get beaten down at the end of the day. If everyone's long on tomatoes, well, you know, they're going to get 10 cents on a dollar sometimes. That doesn't happen here.
Well, we're going to take a break. I love the idea of now the Sysco truck. Everyone's like, there's the Sysco truck. And it's like, no, they're picking up for a small farmer, you know?
That's good because I'm always like, Sysco.
Yeah, right. But...
yeah, you always think of them as the bad guys.
No, totally, right.
In this case, they've really stepped into a very important part of the process of moving food in this country and in a way that is going to have a big impact on our future agricultural scene.
I'm going to stop cutting them off on the highway then.
Yeah. Exactly. Be nice to the Sysco. This is your bigger benefit, Steve, is what you're doing for the truckers now. All the no sustainable green hippies are going to cut the trucks off anymore. But we're going to take a 30-second break and we'll come right back for our last segment.
I'm trying to feed my way around. I want to feel my way around. I've got to keep 2 feet on the ground. Just let me feel my way around. I don't want to fall down. No, 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 no. The girl I used to love, she always nagged. She ran out of nags. Then she put me in a bag. I've got to let me feel my way around. I don't wanna fall down. No, 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 no. It ain't no joke when you're up on the rope. Tell me what would happen if the tightrope broke. I've got to feel my way around. Just let me feel my way around. I don't wanna fall. I'm just like a blind man with a cane. It gets awful slippery when you're walking in the rain. I've got to feel my way around. Just let me feel my way around. I don't want to fall.
Okay, we're back. Steve, are you still on with us?
Yep.
Katie, are you there? Katie?
Yep, I'm
and
here.
Patrick Martins?
I'm here.
Back here at the...
At the Heritage Radio Network.
Yes.
The main course.
Main course. I was going to say center of the plate, but it's main course now.
Yes, thank God.
So, Steve, I had a question. This is Mark Marabella. I had a question regarding just sort of a technical question. As you heard, that is the opening, the opening of our shipping container right now, giving us some breathing room. As you're familiar with that, Katie.
Yes, I am.
Our aeration system here. Steve, I was wondering, you know, from the farmer standpoint, are there sort of distribution points that, like you would say, you know, from wherever point that they all have to sort of ship their stuff, or do those trucks kind of go along the way? I would imagine it would be easier if there was some sort of distribution center or something to the effect.
It's a combination of a couple things. We have Sysco trucks, as you know, they go out full, they come back empty. Depending on kind of routes and the size of some of the pickups, we have a couple ways for stuff to get to our the distribution center with the Sysco warehouse. Either it's being backhauled by a Sysco truck, or the farmers or producers are driving their truck directly to the dock at Sysco. But what's been interesting is really kind of a encouraging event of real community get-together where we've had a couple people kind of stand up and rise up to act as consolidators for a lot of the smaller people. And one of the challenges is we're in the heart of Amish country here, and these guys aren't on Blackberries.
That's interesting, right, of course. So the logistics of it, right.
And, you know, so they're really responsible for a huge amount of product in the Northeast Ohio, the Ohio Valley here. And what we've got now is three really progressive kind of liaisons who act on behalf of. I got one guy's got represents 40 Amish farmers now, and
wow.
What he'll do is he does all of the logistics stuff. He does all the web-based communication, and then twice a week he's the one who's actually aggregating and bringing that to Cisco on behalf of the Amish.
Yeah, that's interesting because, of course, the Amish at the same time too. They're not going to have big trucks to move their stuff to a point anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's really how do you keep the cold chain alive?
When we were talking with Gene Mayer earlier, one of the things that Baldor emphasizes is the freshness of the product. And so when it goes through these different steps in the process from farm to table, how do you keep it as fresh as you can? And what do chefs do if they don't like what they get?
Yeah, it's a good question. Did you hear that, Steve?
Yeah, I did. And it's key because, everything that when we place an order, that product is still in the ground, or
uh-huh.
in the case of chickens, it's still running around. So we're basically processing orders to order, just in time. So product is never more than 24 hours from the time it was picked.
Wow.
Interestingly, we've seen just the huge difference on product being picked at ripeness, at peak ripeness. And it's just an amazing difference of seeing a peach with a Brix of 14 versus average of 8 coming in here.
Right.
You literally need to pass bibs out. And it's as fresh can be. It's kind of interesting because we're dealing now, you get a case of red peppers, and it's just picked, and you have a shelf life of an extra 10 days if you weren't able to utilize all your red peppers. But kind of changing the way chefs look at the food.
Very interesting.
What is the next step for
it's, local crop?
Yeah, I mean, what is the next step?
Cisco's the go-between, but then what happens next?
Well, we have Cisco's obviously a great partner. One of the things I like to say is local foods should not be elitist. And you look at the Cisco client base across the country, there's over 400,000 clients, and they're mom-and-pop pizza shops to healthcare facilities to fine dining restaurants. And so we launched in Cleveland last summer, and we're now rolling out. We're opening Cisco Central Ohio in another 3 weeks, which is based out of Columbus. And it just the incremental growth is kind of interesting to see. Really making a difference comes with critical mass. And, Cisco Cleveland represents about 3,500 customers. Cisco Columbus is another 4,000 customers, and we're able to start kind of rolling those out across markets. So that's our plan.
Is Columbus going to be a sort of a distribution center or something, like a trucking? What's going to happen in Columbus?
Well, look at the infrastructure. There are 85 Cisco operating companies. There's Cisco New York, Cisco Boston, Cisco Columbus, Cisco Cleveland, et cetera. So it's a perfect growth model for us as we keep proving each marketplace that we can start opening up local crops in each marketplace.
Well, this is unbelievable. We would love to have you back on as a guest, Steve. There's a million things.
Lots more questions.
Katie didn't even get started, but this is Katie's punishment for not coming in.
That's right.
Kidding. Katie, Mark's not as pretty as you, but he did a good job, filling in. And
he did. I'm glad he was there to, keep things going and to make you feel like you're not all alone in a fish tank.
I know. I can't drink all this sake by myself. No, but it's been awesome. Katie, Godspeed recovery to your sister.
Thank you, my dear. I'll pass that on.
And thank you, Steve. We'll hopefully have you on many, many times again during the history of the network.
Well, thanks, guys. Have a great Sunday, and feel free to call me anytime.
Thanks.
Terrific. Thanks very much for participating, Steve. That was great.
You're most welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.